The Tailor's Guild is a work of fiction. Like a good story and a good suit, you can put it on as much as you like, and it becomes more familiar each time. Content warnings are available in the show notes. If you have a specific trigger, let us know and we'll begin warning for it. Now, settle in, feel our comfortable coat on your shoulders, and enjoy the show. A plutocratic elite. A forgotten working class? Machines powered by magic. Fine suits and solidarity. This is the Tailor's Guild. When it rained, New Dawn City drowned. Rarely was there a light rain. It was either bright sun or torrential downpour. Droplets tamped down the thick smoke that usually filled the lower parts of the city, carrying dark water through gutters and across sidewalks in search of lower ground. Vibrant streaks of clean paint were drawn down the buildings, which were usually caked with that ever-present orange-flecked residue. Anyone unlucky enough to be walking, instead of taking a skycar or staying indoors, stepped carefully to avoid soaking their shoes in the dirty water. Yaz was sitting next to a window in one of a skycar's narrow seats, taking care not to let her umbrella touch her suit. She was wearing her embroidered rose suit, the only one she currently had. She had worn little else since she had gotten it, and quickly discovered which elements of her wardrobe went with it and which did not. The cheerful yellow shirt, for instance, did not work, but the formal red one did. Now that she actually had the suit in her hands, none of her other clothes seemed to feel quite right. Already she was planning her next one. It would have to capture the other half of her wardrobe, and she had picked out the fabric in her mind already. A thick purple tweed that she had found, dusty and creased, behind a shelf while doing inventory one day. Zara had laughed about it. Apparently, it was a special order from a client in celebration of a big promotion he was due for, which he then failed to get, and the shop had been unable to contact him or get reimbursed for the fabric, despite repeated attempts and calls. Sydney, in a fit of rage, had gone to his office in one of the skyscrapers downtown. Security had been quite firm about not doing that again. The only question now was what to do with it. Sydney, for all his acerbity, had the greatest connection to other tailors' shops. He threw himself into the sewing almost constantly. He would send work to other shops when he got overwhelmed, and take on extra work in quiet periods. Sometimes he would be helped by Zara, and rarely by Harry when it was something easy. And he would uncomplainingly work on suits for the tailors, if they asked nicely. Every shop did it differently. Some used a credit system, some loaned suits out and altered them. But the tailors at Ramos & Son Bespoke Clothiers, established 784, were afforded rare breadth in their fashion choices. The one time Yaz had asked about sewing, Sydney had growled, "Let's get you proper on measuring before we talk about that," and she hadn't pushed it. Yaz had settled on something double-breasted, but that was as far as she'd gotten. She wondered how confident Sydney felt about wide skirts. They couldn't be that different from pants, could they? It was her day off, and she was traveling farther afield than she'd ever gone in New Dawn City, far outside the meager realm of home and work. The skycar station had been easy to find, but she kept her eyes glued to the route map on the wall to make sure she didn't miss her stop. The rain was rattling on the roof of the skycar as it propelled itself along its preset route. Below, the cars and marchers moved along the roads, the sounds of their engines eerily muffled by the rain. Yaz hoped the journey would be worth it. For the thousandth time, she checked the white invitation she was holding. It was embossed with a stylized turtle and announced an evening of class and luxury, experiencing a specially curated collection of art from Aurelios. The invitation had been sent to her address, no doubt, because her parents were wealthy Aurelions and could be persuaded to become donors, patrons, or something along those lines. But they hadn't looked up from the stacks of paperwork their new jobs had already furnished them with, and Yaz took the invitation. Now here she was, riding an unfamiliar sky car, alone, through a downpour. Maybe a new raincoat would be a good investment. Yaz was wearing her old raincoat. It was well made and expensive, since her parents had bought it for her, but it was too small, and the sleeves were too short, and it caused her suit to wrinkle uncomfortably. She'd ask Zara where to get a nice, inexpensive one. Zara would know. It was disconcerting how different the stark, gray rain of New Dawn City was when compared to the colorful summer storms of Aurelios. The day of Yaz's final practice locus exam, the first of the season, swept over the capital city of Capestius, lashing the trees and sending torrents of water down the gutters on either side of the wide streets. She had been a terrified 18-year-old, years ahead of her peers, trying to keep every piece of possible information in her head. Her coach, Mr. Pavlis, had walked the entire way to the examination hall with her, holding an umbrella over her head. The sky car ground to a halt, and Yaz leapt to her feet, not sure how long the doors would stay open, and not wanting to miss her stop. She splashed out into the rain and opened her umbrella, a little too late. At least the droplets that now freckled her shoulders were clean water. She was in Painter's Quarter, totally unfamiliar territory. Harry stared out the window. Raindrops were running horizontally along the window as the little red whim sped along B Street. Sydney switched expertly to a turn lane and migrated off the busy thoroughfare onto a much wider freight road. "Oh, come on," he exclaimed under his breath. The freight road was filled with marchers of all different sizes, shapes, and colors, all bearing cargo, or picking it up. Far ahead, Harry could see over the tops of the shorter marchers to the towering cranes and spires that served as aerial docks for the zeppelins and aerokeels. "We're not in a hurry, are we?" Harry asked. "Well, no," Sydney sighed, sitting back in the driver's seat. "But it's a matter of principle." Harry took that in.
"Right.
What are we getting here, exactly?" Sydney grimaced. "It's an unpleasant one. A niter bell." Harry nodded slowly, trying not to betray his complete lack of understanding. "Do you follow?" Sydney asked.
"Absolutely,"
Harry replied. Sydney glanced sideways at him. There were no defenses against Sydney's sideways glances.
"No," Harry admitted.
Sydney half laughed. "It's all right, I didn't expect you to. Niterbells were one of the main monsters we faced in the trenches. Oh, did we hate them. They were pretty small, not much bigger than two human heads, but they floated around like they didn't even know where they were. Then they would flash a bright light so we were disoriented and launch themselves forward to attack. Not too many deaths, but a whole lot of injury and illness."
Harry grimaced. "Why would anyone want one of those things?"
Sydney searched for a decent place to park among the large delivery trucks and cargo marchers. "Client's a collector. If you're rich enough, I guess it doesn't matter why he'd want it. They're banned, of course. No one would want one inside the city. This one is sedated, apparently. It's going to fall off the back of a truck, and we'll be there to catch it."
Sydney regarded Harry's concerned expression and clarified.
"Not literally."
He slid the little red whim into a relatively out-of-the-way spot behind an imports office with some other commuter cars. Hopefully it would blend in. Harry got out first and opened the umbrella to hold over the driver's side door. Sydney got out, leaning heavily on his cane and swearing under his breath. It was the perfect storm of annoyance. The rain made his missing leg ache, and he didn't want to risk damaging his usual burnished wood cane. It had been a gift, and while he didn't know the exact cost, he knew he would be unable to replace it.
"You okay?" Harry asked, worried. Sydney grimaced and waved away the concern, straightening up and stretching. Harry was wearing his brown tweed suit, and Sydney was wearing a gorgeous but understated soft green moleskin three-piece.
They wouldn't blend in with the dock workers by any stretch of the imagination, but at the very least they wouldn't stand out so vibrantly. They made their way deeper into the warrens of the new Dawn City harbor, sidestepping the cargo marchers and shouting crewmen as much as they could. A delivery truck raced by, rattling the pockmarked wooden planks of the raised access road and splattering oily mud over the two tailors' pant legs. "Perfect," Sidney grumbled. He reached into his pocket and fished out the note the client had given them. "Spire 13, looks like. It's over there," he indicated with his jaw. "Lead the way," said Harry. It was called the Swordfish Gallery, according to Yaz's card, and located in a tower called the Hennings Building. She was unaccountably nervous, which she told herself was because she was in an unfamiliar part of town, and nothing more. She located the building easily enough. It was an attractive building, in the new minimalist style that Yaz had seen when going shopping for furniture with her parents, but rarely in buildings. She supposed stylistic trends could be replaced in decoration, more often than in stone edifices. The name Swordfish itself was a cultural hallmark. The fish were considered harbingers of good luck back home, and Swordfish Plaza was where the central government building stood in Capestius, the capital of Aurelios. Yaz pushed down the pangs of homesickness and entered the Hennings Building. The lobby was immaculate and well-furnished, with a complex chandelier hanging over a small sitting area. The attendant in the lobby looked up and smiled politely as Yaz entered. "What are you looking for, madam?" the attendant asked, perhaps sensing Yaz's hesitancy. She was young, too, a few years older than Yaz, and she wore a formal black dress with an angular neckline. "The Swordfish Gallery?" There was that unconscious question again. Yaz pushed away the disappointment in herself. The attendant indicated the stairs. "Sixth floor." Yaz hurried up the stairs before she could flee, and found herself confronted by a door with a single-line silhouette of a swordfish emblazoned on it. She took a deep breath and stepped inside. The gallery was quiet and nearly empty. The walls were a cool neutral. Yaz hadn't been in many art galleries, but she knew this to be the norm. Hardly anyone else was there. The invitation hadn't said a mid-morning of class and luxury, after all, but Yaz had wanted to see the art first. The idea of an exhibition of Aurelian art had intrigued her. Of course, there were great artists in Aurelios, but the legal scholars were held in highest esteem. Everyone wanted their child to grow up into a legendary lawyer, and oh, how close Yaz had gotten. But then... Yaz shoved the memories away. As Yaz wandered the gallery, she found her eyes drawn to the small cards listing the names of the artists. None she immediately recognized, although it felt surprisingly good to see so many familiar-sounding names. Then, as she turned a corner, she was confronted by a piece that covered nearly the entire wall. It was a mosaic of some sort. Yaz approached it, hesitating, but needing to see closer. It depicted a small house, made of white stucco, with terracotta tiles for a roof. More red tiles formed a little staircase that left the house and ambled downwards towards an inviting blue sea. It wasn't just a painting. The lines were too angular. Standing too close caused the scene to dissolve into its composite shapes. As Yaz scrutinized it, she realized what was causing the effect. Thousands of pieces of paperwork, forms, official notices, dipped in paint and folded and layered together to create the vision of the little house and the deep ocean. The card next to it announced that the name of the piece was Letters from Home. Yaz stood silent, transfixed. Letters from Home sat there on the wall, innocuously. Of course, Yaz's home had been much larger, and had had uniformed attendants and two cars. But the white stucco, the tiles, the glorious sea, had all been ripped from her memory. She wanted to run down those small steps and sink into the radiant ocean, until all she could feel was the joy of her home, and none of the pain. The spires were used as Zeppelin docks. Aerokeels could dock there in rare instances too, but Zeppelins were more common as cargo craft, since you could leave a Zeppelin floating somewhere without running its engines pretty easily, and Aerokeels, especially the hulking former battleships, needed constant power to keep them airborne. The Aerokeel docks, which resembled dry docks for ocean-going vessels, were farther down the harbor. Years ago, a much younger Harry had been beside himself with excitement, watching the massive hulks of metal lifting off and sliding into port. They had seemed much too large for that sort of thing. Spire 13 was made of prefabricated metal plates bolted to I-beams, which extended far above the ground. The docking spires were staggered, with several rows of different heights to allow room for the maximum amount of Zeppelins. Right now, there were nearly a dozen crowded in among the spires, and workers swarmed over them, hauling crates to the teeming mass of delivery trucks and marchers waiting below. Harry and Sidney sidestepped two crew members with long oiled jackets and knit caps, hefting a wooden crate labeled Fragile, and made for Spire 13. All of the spires had stairs and a ladder for emergencies, but the main point of the spires was to be shafts for the massive cargo elevators that carted the many tons of products and supplies that flowed through the port every day. Spire 13 was no different, and as the two tailors approached the protective doors of the elevator swung open, and a worker wearing a quorum-powered steel exoskeleton stepped out. She was hefting a wooden crate more than 3 meters long like it was nothing, and as she deposited it on the back of a waiting truck, the exosuit's engine whined and spit black smoke. Sidney nodded politely to her, and gestured towards the cargo elevator with his chin to Harry. Harry looked momentarily askance. "We're getting on?" Sidney shrugged. "What do you want me to do, take the stairs?" That was a fair point, and didn't need a reply. Harry stepped aboard the cargo elevator, and after a moment of maneuvering, Sidney joined him. Harry almost expected to be stopped by someone, but none of the several workers who clambered aboard even seemed to register their presence. What Mr. Ramos had said in the Sun Shrine was true. A tie and a sense of purpose, and most people wouldn't even notice you. The cargo elevator stopped with a dreadful, grinding shudder, and the two security doors swung open. The workers filed out hastily, keeping to one side so others could carry more cargo in. They had an easy, shared competency in their movements. It was mesmerizing to watch. Idly, Harry wondered if he looked like that when pinning garments. Harry stared around, taking in the wide platform where the Zeppelin's cargo hatch had been locked into place. More prefabricated panels made up the ceiling and the floor, but the walls were made of rigid mesh. Harsh rain lashed the sides of the spire, collecting in the mesh and running down in rivulets to make puddles on the floor. From this high, Harry could see the entirety of the harbor, and the broad swaths of low tenement buildings and warehouses beyond. Past that, the ever-present black smoke obscured everything below the tips of beautiful skyscrapers, glimmering in the rain. Sidney jogged Harry with his elbow. "That fellow over there," he indicated a red-haired person with mutton chops that were drooping in the rain, "says he can let us aboard for a few minutes to look, but only after all the cargo's unloaded. The Zeppelin will be starting pre-flight operations. You'll only have a few minutes." Harry swallowed nervously and nodded several times. "I can do that. I can do that." Sidney smiled grimly. "All we have to do now is wait." If the Red Workers' Party pamphlet had impressed one thing on Harry in his several curious readings of it, it was the importance of talking to other people on the job and building connections. As the crowds of workers expertly ferried resources to and from the Zeppelin, Harry took in a deep breath. "Sidney, do you know about the Workers' Party?" Sidney, who had also been looking curiously at the harbor below, glanced down at Harry sharply. "Who have you been talking to?" Harry shrugged, suddenly hesitant. This hadn't been the response he'd expected. No one. I just saw something about it and looked interesting." Sidney grimaced. "It's not a good idea, Harry. Don't get involved. I'm serious." Harry shifted uncomfortably and drew breath to say something more when Sidney cut him off. The mutton-chopped fellow was waving them towards the Zeppelin's cargo hold emphatically. They didn't need her here. Letters from Home was a masterpiece, a declaration of love for Yaz's homeland, a homeland Yaz had let down. This entire evening would be a celebration of Aurelius, and there was no part of that that Yaz deserved to be present for. The gallery would fill with competent officials, diplomats, artists, people who could be proud of their accomplishments. The invitation wasn't hers, it was for her parents, two people whose footsteps Yaz would never have another chance to follow in, never have another chance to make the correct choice, to have the correct career. Why had she thought she could attend, could be accepted? No one would notice her. The first time Yaz had been noticed, she was 7. One of her argumentation essays had won a national prize, and she stood on stage in a yellow dress and smiled shyly at a flashbulb while a tall man with a wide smile shook her hand. She had stood on a box so she could fit in the picture. The second time Yaz had been noticed, a gentleman named Mr. Pavlis, who wore a bow tie and smelled of chalk, spoke quietly to her parents after debate club. Yaz was very talented, he said, and with proper tutelage she could grow into a legal mind that could rival half the famous names in Aurelius's long and storied law history. The third time Yaz had been noticed, she placed at the top of her class and became the youngest person to take the locus exam for law. Mr. Pavlis had bought her a set of thick legal volumes and a celebratory dinner. The fourth time no one noticed. She had been studying for weeks and months on end, barely looking up from her books. Mr. Pavlis's words were comforting, as long as she was doing what she should. She studied some days in groups with other similarly dedicated young scholars, but most days she spent alone, in the library. That day, a single question occupied the entirety of her focus, a question she had diligently resisted asking, for longer than she cared to admit. What if I don't want this? Of course she wanted it. She'd been training for it her whole life, hadn't she? She was good at it, wasn't she? But the question wouldn't go away. The day of the locus exam came. She scored a 10 out of a possible 1,000 points. Mr. Pavlis must have noticed, because he has never heard from him again. When her parents were offered roles at a prestigious law firm in New Dawn City, she quietly asked to go with. Sharing a worried look, they agreed. They were celebrated when they left, a circuit of farewell parties hosted by their esteemed peers. Yaz stayed silent, or stayed home. But this gallery? An evening of class and luxury? This was filled with people who Aurelius wanted. This was for people who had brought their joy and love for their homeland over the Sharpwater Sea with them. Yaz had only brought her fears. She fled. Back out in the world, the rain rattled against the building sides and shook the umbrella handle that she gripped fiercely. Someone brushed past her, coat collar turned up against the deluge. She couldn't go home, it was too early. Her parents would be worried, and then when they discovered she had lied, they would fall silent and share another of those unbearable looks. Only a few blocks away, atop a worn-down brick building, were the bright lights and colorful railings that indicated a rooftop restaurant. Yaz could see the fluttering edges of umbrellas. Despair was bad, but despair on an empty stomach in the pouring rain was worse. She threw herself into a seat at the most isolated table she could find. A waiter with a slim mustache and a Parotal accent that sometimes sounded like Mr. Ramos and sometimes sounded quite different recommended a type of pasta she couldn't pronounce, so she just nodded gratefully. At least here, facing away from anyone else and towards the anonymous, smoke-choked city, she could cry without anyone looking at her. Harry started running. He sprinted up the rattling steel ramp and into the enormous belly of the cargo zeppelin. His well-polished brogue slipped on a patch of oily water, but he caught himself. Behind him, Sidney called out, "Solicited as glassware, under the name of Edward Royce!" Harry tossed off an acknowledging shout over his shoulder and kept running. The zeppelin crew wore orange canvas jumpsuits, with fur collars and breathing masks and goggles, along with the ubiquitous dockworker knit caps. His brown suit might have helped him blend in on the ground, where anyone might nominally be walking around, but it certainly wouldn't help here. Thankfully, no one appeared to see him as he frantically aimed for the collection of boxes nearest the front of the cargo zeppelin's mouth. They were all busy doing something with a lever and a long length of very thick chain. Harry reached the stack of boxes and began to tear through them, reasoning that since its manifest had listed it as being delivered that day, it would have been brought to the front, but not removed, since, of course, no one was waiting for it. No one was waiting for it legally, that is. The first few boxes were too small to hold anything but stacks of documents, and Harry set them aside as carefully as time would allow. But under them was a thick wooden box, inscribed with an image of elegant fluted glasses. Harry scrambled for the tag and wiped smudging rain off his glasses to see the name. Yes, was it Mr. Edward Royce. He tucked the box under one arm, surprised by how light it was. It stood to reason, of course. Any beast that could float, as Sidney described, wouldn't be that heavy. There didn't appear to be any signs of life from the box. Only a single air hole. Then Harry skidded to a stop, grabbing a steel girder for support. So that was what the Zeppelin crew had been doing, with the lever and the chain. They were lifting off. The Zeppelin was now a good 3 meters from the spire docking bay's edge, and Harry could see Sidney and the mutton-chop fellow standing at the edge, shouting and gesticulating wildly. Their words were being sucked away by the deafening rush of wind from the Zeppelin's now active propellers. Harry ran the last few steps to where the Zeppelin's cargo ramp was slowly being drawn up. Two of the breathing-masked crew turned jerkily towards him. One of them, voice muffled by the mask, shouted, "Kid, what are you doing here? You can't be here!" Harry saw the slowly receding platform, the look of horror on Sidney's face, the imagined fury of Mr. Edward Royce if he didn't receive his beast of war at exactly the time he demanded it. Harry took a deep breath, gritted his teeth, and started to run. Leaping a yawning chasm is not as easy as the stories make it seem. It feels a good deal less grand, for one thing, and you can't really maintain a dramatic pose if you hope to actually make it to the other side. Harry didn't so much leap as simply run off the edge of the Zeppelin's cargo bay. For an instant, he thought he might make it. He was in the air, the platform was growing nearer and nearer, but not quite near enough. Eyes screwed shut, Harry flung Mr. Edward Royce's box out towards the platform. Sidney surged forward, his free hand extending out to catch Harry, but it was too late. Harry's forearm hit the steel edge of the platform with a sickening, sharp snap, and he fell. Rain spattered the edges of the platform, quickly wiping away the smear of Harry's blood. When you sink your fingers into steel mesh, it feels terrible. It grinds against your fingernails, and it scrapes the skin of your palms. But it is uniquely agonizing when it is the only thing keeping you from a long fall and a sudden stop. Harry, clinging on with both hands for dear life, knew vaguely that he was screaming. He could hear Sidney above screaming, too. The mutton-chopped fellow and several other burly dock workers were leaning out over the edge. Then they disappeared. Harry was losing his grip. He really regretted going to look for that package. One of the dock workers had a harness on. She was swinging out over the gap, descending slowly to where Harry was. "Hey, kid, let go when I tell you to, okay?" The dock worker positioned herself behind him and wrapped her arms around his torso. Her breath was hot on his ear. "Now!" Harry let go. Next came a hazy blur of movement, of pain, of yet more screaming. Then he felt something soft and warm. Harry blinked several times. He was wrapped in a blanket, huddled in the passenger seat of the little red Whim. Sidney was driving very cautiously and staring straight ahead. "I'm taking you to a doctor," he said. "I don't have the money for that," Harry murmured. Sidney's inscrutable silence radiated outward, and Harry felt even worse. "Where do you want me to take you, then?" he asked. Harry tried to shift in his seat, and his arm cried out, "Just home, please." They drove in silence. Rain tapped the window gently, and Harry was just beginning to doze off when Sidney spoke again. "I served on an artillery marcher. Mostly we stayed with the infantry in the trenches, providing them cover and backup. So we saw a lot of each other, marcher crews, ground soldiers. A few of the boys decided to band together. They wanted decent foods, duty shifts shorter than 14 hours, that sort of thing. For a couple of days, they shut down all operations in our division's trenches to make their point." Sidney drew a long, deep, shaky breath. "Command had them executed and the war went on. Don't get involved, Harry. I don't want you to get hurt." "I think that's all for now. Yours sincerely, The Storyteller." The Tailor's Guild. Season 1, Episode 4. Letters from Home. Was written by Jules Blymore. Produced by Jules Blymore. Starring Jules Blymore as the storyteller. Original music by Colin Tidwell, with Thomas Tidwell Consulting. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend, or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Send us a message at thetailorsguildcast@gmail.com, or on Twitter and Tumblr at The Tailors Guild. New episodes on the 7th and 21st. Thank you for listening. Join a union.